Srila Prabhupada. It is true that by practicing restraint of the senses by the yoga system, one can get relief from the disturbances of desire and lust. But this is not sufficient to give satisfaction to the soul. For this satisfaction is derived from devotional service to the personality of Godhead. Purport. Yoga aims at controlling the senses. By practice of the mystic process of bodily exercise in thinking, in sitting, thinking, feeling, willing, concentrating, meditating, and at last being merged into transcendence, one can control the senses. The senses are considered like venomous serpents, and the yoga system is just to control them. On the other hand, Narada Muni recommends another method for controlling the senses in the transcendental loving service of Mukunda, the personality of Godhead. By his experience, he says, the devotional service to the Lord is more effective and practical than the system of artificially controlling the senses. In the service of the Lord Mukunda, the senses are transcendentally engaged. Thus, there is no chance of their being engaged in sense satisfaction. The senses want some engagement. To check them artificially is no check at all, because as soon as there is some opportunity for enjoyment, the serpent-like senses will certainly take advantage of it. There are many such instances in history, just like Vishwamitra Muni's falling a victim to the beauty of Menaka. But Thakura Haridas was allured at midnight by the well-dressed Maya, and still she could not induce that great devotee into her trap. The whole idea is that without devotional service to the Lord, neither the yoga system nor dry philosophical speculation can ever become successful. Pure devotional service of the Lord, without being tinged with fruitive work, mystic yoga, or speculative philosophy, is the foremost procedure to attain self-realization. Such pure devotional service is transcendental in nature, and the system of yoga and jnana, systems of yoga and jnana, are subordinate to such a process. When the transcendental devotional service is mixed with a subordinate process, it is no longer transcendental, but is called mixed devotional service. Srila Vyasadeva, the author of Srimad Bhagavatam, will gradually develop all these different systems of transcendental realization in the next text. The word transcendental is a difficult one in English because it is used by philosophers and theologians who don't really have a clear idea most of the time what it's supposed to mean. It's just a fancy word to mean, you know, the other realm, perfect, the unknown, the occult. It's not clearly defined, and so many different thinkers have different ideas, different vague ideas. Not only vague ideas, but an assortment of different vague ideas about what transcendence might be. Because the word, you know, by derivation, it means going above, going beyond something. Transcend means to rise above something. I'm angry at somebody. If I can put aside that anger, I've transcended the anger. I've gone above it. But in philosophical and religious discussions, the word is used vaguely without a clear idea of what you are going above, what is there above, how do you actually get there. Just like in Plato's philosophy, he talks about the ideal reality, that the things of this world are just copies of the reality. This table is not the real table, it's just a fake table. The real table exists in the world of ideas.
Yeah.
But where's this world of ideas? Is it really a separate place? And if it is, where is it? And what is the nature, what's the substance of these real tables? I thought this was a table made out of wood. What are the real tables made out of? And Plato, or rather Socrates, originally talking about this, Plato is his disciple, and he's the one who wrote down the teachings of Socrates and tried to systematize them. But on this, he remained vague. What is the real world? What is the ideal reality? He just said there is such a thing, but he couldn't really explain what it is, or where it is, or how it is. So the idea of transcendence, some concept of transcendence, but not a clear idea. Prabhupada's also using the word, but we can clearly understand what kind of transcendence we're talking about. Everything, nothing transcends the Supreme Lord. There's nothing separate from the Supreme Lord and his energies. Everything is within the scope of the Supreme Lord and his energies. There's no transcending that. But there are different qualities of energies. There's hierarchy. That means one is above another. Okay, now we get one above another, we can talk about transcending. You can transcend the first floor to go to the second floor. And the Lord has superior and inferior energies. In fact, all of his varieties of energies appear in both forms, material, spiritual and material. So transcendence means to get out of the material world and go to the spiritual world. To give up entanglement with the inferior energies of the Lord and instead take shelter of the original spiritual energies. And by doing that, you're taking shelter of the Lord. Daibhiyesha gunamayi mama maya durachaya mami vayepa pajante mayam etam tarantite. My lower inferior energy is practically impossible to get free from, but if you take shelter of me, you can. Mahatmanas tumam parta daivim prakritim ashritaha padyantyananas ananyamanaso gatva bhutadi mavyayam. Those who take shelter of my divine spiritual energy, they can worship me intently without deviation, with all dedication. And of course, by worshiping Krishna, you become free. And beyond that, you can attain love for Krishna. But it involves taking shelter of the spiritual energy, transcending, changing the channel. From material channel to spiritual channel. So, actually, the verse and the translation don't talk about transcendence. The purport is talking about transcendence. But the point of the statement of Narada is that the perfection of life, he's talking in terms of the soul becoming pacified. But how do you pacify the soul? Not by sticking a rubber ducky and a rubber nipple in his mouth like a baby, or by adults you have to pacify them with sense gratification, or maybe some money or something, to make them distracted from their troubles. But the soul is not pacified by these material things. How is the soul pacified? By transcending. So without using the word, the idea is implied. The soul is not pacified means he doesn't become free from attachment to matter. We know that from other contexts. That's what the only thing that will pacify the self. Savai pumsam paro dharmo yato bhaktirudhoksaje ohoituki apatiyata yayatma supersedati. This is the highest dharma. Discipline, highest responsible behavior of the living entity. Whatever will help him achieve love for the transcendent Lord. That is, well, actually, bhakti, devotion, which is uninterrupted and unmotivated. Yayatma supersedity, and that pure devotional service will give full satisfaction to the self. So we know from elsewhere in the Bhagavatam that pacifying the self means achieving pure devotion. And we know also from the Bhagavatam and elsewhere that one who has pure devotion is already liberated. The endeavor for liberation is automatically achieved by acquiring bhakti, shuddha bhakti. So that we're not speculating unjustifiably by taking the statement here that the soul becomes pacified to mean that he attains liberation. So, but that's how Prabhupada describes it. Talks about transcending in the purport, not about being pacified, but about transcending. They're equivalent. Soul will not be pacified, will not become peaceful otherwise than by transcending the material attachment and becoming attachment to the spiritual, attached to the spiritual instead. So what Narada is saying here in this statement is that the other methods of spiritual discipline other than the service of Lord Mukunda are inadequate for this purpose. As Prabhupada clarifies in the purport, by yoga practice of controlling the senses, by bodily exercise, you can do that. You can achieve a control of the senses. But that is not in itself the ultimate goal of life. Those who have been able to control their senses, there's no guarantee that those senses will stay controlled forever. Many examples of great, powerful yogis practicing the standard meditational process who fell down from their elevated state because Maya is stronger than them. Sobhadi Muni, for example, very powerful yogi, meditating under the water. Who can stay under the water? What human person in a human body can remain living underwater indefinitely? He was doing that for a long time, living under the water. Ordinary person, only a great yogi can do this. And still, just by seeing two fish doing what all creatures do, he became agitated and fell down. Seriously. He went out, gave up all his discipline, and became a sense gratifier for some time. Temporary fall down, but still a real fall down. That is the insecurity of the standard yoga systems. There's no guarantee. Prabhupada gives the example of desire in the heart, the seed of desire. That's described in the Padma Purana. That, was it, Palon Mukham, Bijam Kutam Palon Mukham. That desire is aparabdha palam karma kutam bijam palon mukham. That our karmic, the dynamics of karma, which are based on desire and then activity that is motivated by desire, it goes deep. It's not just on the surface. You may modify your surface behavior, but the seeds of desire are still deep in the heart. Prabhupada gives the example. Actually, he's talking about this short statement of Kapiladeva. Jarayat yashuya kosham nigirnam analoyata. The kosha, which is the covering of... It doesn't mean that you're... Someone has tied you up in a bag and is going to throw you in a lake. You know, he's like the gangsters used to do in America. They get, you know, they want to just get rid of somebody, but also get rid of the dead body so that they don't get in trouble. the police don't find the body, so they have a simple procedure. Chicago, where the gangsters used to stay, is on a big lake, Lake Michigan. So they would simply take you out to the docks and put your feet in cement and put you in a bag and throw you in the water. And that's the end of you, and nobody finds you.
Why did I say that?
The seas of desire. Oh, okay. Shoreyat Yashuyah Kosham. Oh, Kosham. I was talking about the word Kosha, which means a sheath or a bag or an envelope. It's not that kind of envelope. It's someone that actually literally ties you up in an envelope or puts you in a bag. It's the subtle body. This is the envelope, the bag we're all in. We're all tied up in a bag, which is our subtle body. Even in the gross body, we can eliminate that. You know, there are various ways to kill yourself, and even if you don't commit suicide, you're going to die, and you'll be relieved of the gross body. But your subtle body is still there, and you take it from one gross body to another until you attain liberation. But who knows how many thousands of lifetimes it will take me to achieve liberation by ordinary means. No saying how long, how many lifetimes it can take. And only then are you out of this bag of the Linga Sharira. But Kapiladev says that pure bhakti is more potent than all other spiritual disciplines. Why? What's so special about it? Jadayat Yashu Yahakosham. This bag is dissolved. The subtle body is dissolved immediately. Ashu, or very quickly. Just as food that you eat is rapidly digested. It has to be. The digestive system in your body has to be fast acting. Otherwise the food rots and your body becomes full of poison. So it has to be digested within 24 hours or else you get sick. Even if the digestion doesn't start practically immediately, you get sick. That's why there's enzymes in the saliva, in the mouth. When you eat something with sugar, some of us don't take too many sweets, but we all take some sugar in our food. Some people take a lot. Some people are addicted to it, and they get diabetes. But everybody is taking some sugar in their food. It's in, even if you're just eating vegetables, there's some sugar in the vegetables. But sugars are very complex organic chemicals. It's not easy for them to be broken down in digestion. They're very complex and hard to pull apart. Carbohydrates are not easy to digest, and sugars are complex carbohydrates. So the process has to start quick. Therefore, saliva is there in the mouth that contains an enzyme, petechthin or something, that takes sugar and starts breaking it down. Or actually, yes, starch is turned into sugar first. Actually, plain starches, carbohydrates, are worse than sugars. But the enzyme in the saliva in your mouth takes the starches, like you eat a salty cracker, leave it in your mouth before you swallow it for 1 minute, and it starts to taste sweet. Because that saliva is actually starting to break down the carbohydrates into first sugars, and then the sugars are broken down in the stomach by the strong acids in the stomach and strong enzymes. So strong that if you had them on your skin, they would burn your skin. Hydrochloric acid. But the stomach has strong lining and mucus. It can tolerate these strong acids. But it has to be digested quickly and passed out of the body. The poisons have to be passed out. That's why you cannot avoid going to the toilet. Because otherwise your body is full of poison. A few hours, retaining the poison to your body for a few hours will disrupt your health very seriously. So there's need in digestion for quick breakdown of the foods and elimination of the poison part. So the example is given. Devotional service very quickly dissolves the subtle body, just as food is quickly dissolved in the digestive system. Prabhupada, talking on that same verse, he gives another example of a chickpea, Chanakya, Kablijana. Chickpea is normally kept in, it doesn't grow dry on the trees. It's a green, you know, moist seed. But when you take it off the tree, it dries out and turns a little brownish white. And it can stay for many years. You can probably keep a chickpea for thousands of years. And then you put it in water and it comes back to life. And the little baby chickpea plant can grow out of it. So this is the problem. Suppose I want to make sure I don't get any chickpea plants for some reason. You have to destroy the chickpea. Just drying it out, even leaving it around for 1,000 years, won't eliminate the possibility it might come back to life. But if I make a masala in the frying pan, put some oil, heat it up, and then throw the chickpeas into the hot chunk, then the chickpeas will be fried. And the fried chickpea is dead. It will never come back to life. So devotional service is like that. It fries the seeds of desire, toasts them, roasts them, and then they can never fructify again. But the ordinary yoga processes, they may dry out the seeds of desire, but they don't kill them. And those dry seeds, when properly watered, can come back to life. That's the point Prabhupada makes in the purport. To check, there's no chance. To check the senses artificially is no check at all. Because as soon as there's some opportunity for enjoyment, the serpent-like senses will certainly take advantage of it. And there are many such instances in history, just like Vishwamitra Muni, his falling a victim to the beauty of Menaka. And the counterexample is Haridas Thakur. But Thakur Haridas was allured at midnight by the well-dressed Maya, and still she could not induce the great devotee into her trap. Having made this point, Narada is making him his strong recommendation that every living being who is interested in transcendence, not false idea of transcendence, but is interested in actually getting out of the entanglement of material existence, he or she should take to the processes of pure devotional service. The other means are not certain, and they're very difficult. Okay. So any questions or comments? Yes, Damodar Gopal?
Thank you. It's important of the purport that you didn't spoke about, but I have some questions.
Okay.
But,
you didn't speak.
I mean,
did not speak. No, you didn't speak. You have to use the infinitive speak, not spoke.
Yeah.
You don't say you didn't spoke.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for correcting that. Is that pure devotional service should be? I mean, I guess you spoke about it, without pure. Should be pure without contaminations of yoga and jnana, and then. When the transcendental devotional service is mixed with the subordinate process, is no longer transcendental, but is called mixed devotional service. Srila Vyasadeva, the author of Srimad Bhagavatam, will gradually develop all these different systems of transcendental realization in the text. So we'll gradually develop all these different systems of transcendental realization in the text. So I'm wondering if you can elaborate on this.
In that context, we have to understand transcendental doesn't just mean in some vague way spiritual. Mixed devotional service, we don't say it's not spiritual, but it's spiritual mixed with material. And when your spiritual endeavors are mixed, when they're tainted by material, When your sweet rice has a little sand in it, it's not palatable. So the problem is that mixed devotional service, it may be good because it's got some percentage of spiritual value in it, but it's not 100%. And therefore, it's not transcendental, means it doesn't give you actual liberation. You don't achieve, what to speak of love of God, you don't even achieve liberation from birth and death by mixed devotional service. You stay in the material world as long as you're still practicing a mixed process. That's what it means, not transcendental.
It
means it doesn't actually take you out of the material existence.
Thank you. It says that that Srila Vyasadeva develops this team of gradually develop all these different systems of transcendental realization.
Well, the Vedic system does. And Vyasadeva presented the Vedic system of sacrifice. Sacrifice, which is karma, and then jnana and yoga. These karma, jnana, and yoga, they were taught by Vyasadeva when he edited the Vedas. Yata dharma adayas charta munivar yano varnita. Yes, Narada said, you've done a good job in describing the processes which give you dharma, karma, and artha, which are karma, jnana, and yoga. But you failed to purely describe the Supreme Lord and His glories and His devotional service.
So it says that throughout the Bhagavatam, it seems that this is gradually going to develop until the 10th canto. The 10th canto is like a pure, it's pure bhakti. Describe
Bhagavatam from the beginning to the end is teaching pure bhakti.
It is pure bhakti, but it seems that you have many examples that will illustrate your examples of mixed devotional service.
When he's giving examples of mixed devotional service, he's telling us what not to do.
Yes.
What examples of mixed devotional service?
We just read today Devotee, at the end they all become pure devotees. But
well,
you
not
see
all,
the process.
Not all. There no. are 30. There are 3,200 people. At least mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Count how many people are said to have attained liberation. What is speak of love of God to even have attained liberation? It's probably less than 40. 32 to 35, maybe you can pick a few more and find maybe 40 people who are explicitly told, or you can deduce, that they attained liberation. So we just... Maybe I was wrong, but I just made the point that by mixed devotional service, you can't attain liberation. So those 40 people out of the 3,200 people in the Bhagavatam, maybe some others did too, but we're not told that they attained liberation. They must have been practicing pure devotional service. Devahuti, we know, went back to Godhead. We're told that. So she was practicing pure devotional service. She was practicing pure devotional service in a previous life. Otherwise, how did Kapiladeva agree to become her son? Supreme Lord became her son. I mean, she already was a pure devotee, even before she took birth as the daughter of Manu.
But how do we accept, like,
So that's not an example of someone who's practicing mixed devotional service.
Okay.
Give me an example of someone who's practicing mixed devotional service, and he's a failure. He doesn't attain liberation in the Bhagavatam.
But they practice devotional service, mixed devotional service at first, but they attain success at the end. Like, for example, Dhruva Maharaj.
If someone gives up mixed devotional service and then enters pure devotional service, fine.
Yeah, but it's a crime. So,
I mean, you can start from a mixed position and then graduate to pure devotional service. That's acceptable.
I was presenting this to actually come to ask this question that I heard from one devotee that it was Guru Sivananda Prabhu who was saying in his class, he was speculating a little bit, he says that the third and fourth cantos of the Bhagavatam, we see an example like King Prachapa, Rishat, who else? Dhruva Maharaj, excuse me, Daksha, many examples of mixed devotees.
But they're people who we shouldn't follow.
Yes, exactly.
Those are counterexamples.
So third and fourth cantos, And then he said, then the fifth canto.
What does speak of description of demigods who are just quarreling with one another and with the demons? Yeah. Quarrelsome demigods. We shouldn't become like them, especially.
Yeah. Right, and then he said that the fifth canto is just. The fifth canto is like Sukadev Goswami. We continue speaking and it gets more heavy. Like, from the fifth canto. You can see the difference of tone. In the narrations of Sukadeva Goswami. And then he was saying that, maybe he took, because Sukadeva Goswami is like heavy transcendence, you know, no mix, just pure bhakti.
Yes.
And that he took Maitreya and Vidura to speak about mixed devotional service. And then back in the fifth canto, like third and fourth canto, and back in the fifth canto, Sukadeva Goswami is back, because you have the second canto is like it starts with pure,
but there is no promotion of mixed devotional service in the Bhagavatam. If there is any, even in the part where someone else is talking, Maitreya and Vidura, then that would make the statement at the beginning a lie. Dharmic projata kaita votra. Forms of cheating religion are excluded from the Bhagavatam. So the Bhagavatam does not promote in any chapter, in any verse, anything other than pure devotional service. I'll stand on that claim.
Yes.
But in certain cantos, there is a strong emphasis on teaching of renunciation. In order for a conditioned soul to become seriously dedicated to Krishna's devotional service, he has to renounce his material entanglement. And so you got to get a disgusting picture of the material world. You got to become disgusted with material life. And so these counterexamples are given, but not to promote them. It's not that Maitreya is promoting mixed devotional service and then we put him aside in the fifth canto, but he's teaching what to give up. He's promoting renunciation of this material entanglement by giving examples of it. In the third canto, in the fourth canto, in the sixth canto, in the eighth and ninth, especially ninth canto, so many examples of counterexamples of what we should not be like. Don't be like these quarrelsome demigods. Don't become like these yogis who end up getting in trouble. Don't become like these mixed devotees who may eventually, after several lifetimes, attain perfection, but they have a hard time of it. Bharat Maharaj, one, two, three, had to take two more births. So these are examples what not to do.
So it's not like a gradual step.
It's not like there's a different program, that the third and fourth canto sort of deviates into a different program. It's the same. It's all the same. Don't forget that it's Shukadev who's telling us what Maitreya and Vidura said. Shukadev is speaking in the third and fourth cantos on top of the conversation between Maitreya. And so it's coming out of his mouth. It's not like he takes a break and he'll be back, you know, in a couple of days. You know, he goes off to Vrindavan, you know. And then comes back in 2 days. No, he's there. He's talking. If it comes out of his mouth, he must agree with it.
But it sounds like there's a gradual elevation that, like, devotees in the ninth canto are better and the devotees in the third canto or fourth canto.
There may be a tendency, but it's not a linear progression. It zigzags. You've got some really great devotees in the early cantos, and you got some really sorry cases in the ninth canto. So it's demigods fighting with each other.
But it's all mixed.
It's not like it's steadily progressing or just in a straight line from better to worse to better. Yeah. Generally worse to better, but zigzagging back and forth. There's so many different cases, persons being dealt with, and they're all individuals. And they're not presented exactly in exact order of worse to better. It's it's more complicated than that.
It seems that the Brihad Bhagavatamrita does that, though.
Well, Narada was trying to do that, but then Krishna told him, "Don't you understand, Narada, that everybody you met is actually my favorite devotee? That I'm satisfied with all of them." So Narada didn't go to any mixed devotees. He went to only the pure devotees in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Second half, Gopikumar visits the worlds where mixed devotion is being practiced. Yeah, okay. No, it's yes, there's a general progression because it's an educational program. And we have to progress gradually. So the Bhagavatam is taking us step by step, yes. But not in a straight line. It's Indian way of going around in circles. Yes.
I heard in on Janmasmi that there was one story about how one of the cowherds advised Nanda Maharaj that, look, you're so old. Why didn't you just... why are you staying at home? You have to go to the forest. And he was so old, but we see... I'm wondering here, in the case of Kardama Muni, he seemed relatively a lot younger, and it seemed like from the chapter this morning that as soon as Devahuti had the daughters, then he was ready at that moment to go to the forest.
He warned her that he was going to do that.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's...
Well, he's an extreme case.
Right.
He's not, you know, he's got other agenda. He's not going to care about the karmakanda, you know, regulations that you should take care of your family. My wife's a yogi. Let her take care of herself. And he's ready to go off.
What about, because he must have known that the Lord told him that he would become his son, so why didn't he stick around for...
Well, he did. He was, you know, he was making a show, he's ready to go, but he knew what was going to happen.
Right. But even when the Lord did come, he kind of went pretty soon.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between him and...
Well, the difference would have been that Kapiladeva would have given instructions to his father. But that's not the way it was supposed to be.
Oh, yeah.
And he was supposed to leave, you know, exit the story. This is part of the Leela. He attained his perfection by going to the forest. It's not like he broke his connection with his son. He's worshiping his son in the forest. That's what a sannyasi is supposed to do. Save his family and save the rest of the world by leaving his family. It's not like a sannyasi is a failure or a person who's neglecting his responsibilities. He's carrying out his responsibility to his wife and children by leaving them. That's sannyas. Otherwise, it's just a neglect of responsibility. And, you know, maybe falsely in the name of sannyas. Real sannyas means to save everybody.
Does the wife... when the husband and wife are married, then if the wife's serving the husband nicely, she gets some percentage of his pious credits for his good activities. But when the husband takes sannyas, does that connection of still valid?
I think so. Especially the wife willingly gives up her husband, lets her husband go, then that's a great pious act. You know, it's an act of... she's a renunciant by accepting her husband's departure. Then she gets great credit for that. Probably gets a bigger share after that. Then it's a spiritual relationship. When neither is too attached. Devotees should be attached, should remain attached when it's appropriate for your service, and the minute it's no longer appropriate, be ready to break it for Krishna's service. Like the Pandavas. They accepted the kingdom of the earth, but as soon as they heard, got the news that Krishna had left the world, Yudhishthira took off his jewelry and his fancy garbs and got ready the same night to leave. And his brothers and his wife all followed him. They all gave up everything immediately when it was obvious that it was time to do that. No, you know, attachment in the sense that they took the kingdom and ruled it and enjoyed it, but were ready to give it up at a moment's notice when necessary.
How does the wife, for example, serve the husband when he's a sannyasi?
Well, she can serve him in absence, just like Vishnupriya served Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he was in her heart. He was, the relationship was still intact. because that he's God. But even if he's, you know, your husband is not God, you can serve him in absence by remembering him. But if you're, if the wife is also an initiated Vaishnava, and then she, like when, if the, you know, there's a problem in the marriage, then usually what is done in Hindu culture is the woman goes back to her father's house. So, in the spirit, and if you're a Vaishnava, then your father is your spiritual master. Then the husband gives the wife back to the spiritual master, in a sense. And she serves her husband, or serves, you know, does her service by serving the spiritual master. If she has one. Okay. Okay, we'll stop now. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.